to the political cesspool known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
That's right, everybody. Welcome to the Political Cesspool Radio Program. I am your host, James Edwards. We appreciate you tuning in to our award-winning broadcast this evening as we come to you live, as always, from AM 1380 WLRM Radio Studios in Memphis, Tennessee. Simulcasting online at thepoliticalcesspool.org and also to the AM-FM affiliate stations of the Liberty News Radio Network scattered about the country. We come to you this evening, Saturday night, September 25th, and I tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, buckle yourselves in for an absolutely barn-burning episode of the Political Cesspool tonight. It is going to be scintillating, and to help me navigate through the murky waters of the Political Cesspool, co-hosting with me tonight this first hour, Bill Rowland. Bill, how are you tonight?
James, I've got on my dancing shoes and my top hat, and I'm really ready for this evening because, as you know, it is top-notch. It is absolutely the kind of show we would like to do every week. We do our best, but this is one of the ones that is the all-star show, I would say, in the sense of being one that we do mainly to let people know out there that we do get the best guests on radio.
We do it better than anyone else, and with that in mind, Bill, why don't you share with our listening audience the reason why we are so particularly excited about tonight's installment of the Political Cesspool?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, tonight we welcome Nick Griffin. Nick Griffin is in England, making a long-distance call to the Political Cesspool to be here tonight. He was educated at two private schools. Nick studied history and then law at Downing College, Cambridge. And he boxed in college. I can relate to that. I was a boxer also. And graduated with an honors degree in law. Nick is married, has four children, and lives in Wales. And he was elected, or joined the BNP in 1995 and was elected to leadership to the BNP by a large majority vote of the membership in a secret ballot in September of 1999 and was reelected with nearly 90% of the vote in 2007. Mr. Griffin was elected to the position of Member of European Parliament for the Northwest of England in June 2009. Mr. Griffin, welcome to the Political Cesspool.
Thank you, Jermaine. Thank you, Bill.
It's great to have you back, Nick. Your last appearance with us was just about a year ago this month, and I'd like to ask you as we start this interview tonight, and by the way, ladies and gentlemen, for everyone tuning in tonight around America and indeed around the world, we are going to show the BBC the proper way to conduct an interview with Nick Griffin. We're very excited to have that opportunity. Nick, what advances has the British National Party made since your last appearance with us over the course of the last year?
Well, James, I'd say most of all, we're still here because the British establishment has done everything they can to get rid of us over the last year. We've had all sorts of attacks, especially a wave of court cases from a taxpayer-funded organization called the Equality Commission, which is there to impose racial equality, regardless of realities of human nature, and they've involved us in a hugely complex and expensive court case to try to close us down, and we're still alive, we're still kicking. We've made other progress, but the simple fact that we're still alive will actually do me at the moment.
That is not to be discounted, Bill. As you know, our radio program itself is an entity that stands up unabashedly for what we call the dispossessed majority here in America. We long to have a political party as prominent as the BNP here on our shores, advancing our interest and preserving our cultural heritage. The job that Nick Griffin has done, the job that the BNP has done, has been absolutely phenomenal, and there is nothing wrong with maintaining the status quo that they have established over there in the United Kingdom, where Nick is appearing live with us this evening, just past midnight over there, staying up late, burning the midnight oil to be our guest. And he's got a lot to talk about tonight. We're going to cover a lot of issues, and with that in mind, Bill, what's the first one?
Well, the first issue, of course, is that in the United States, we only have a two-party system that does not represent anybody from the majority. So Nick has the advantage of us. He's got, I think, three or four parties that BNP can compete with. We only, there are two parties here that don't represent the white American majority. But Mr. Griffin, currently the British National Party is running a special campaign based on a consensus of public opinion regarding the troops, British troops in Afghanistan. And, of course, both American and British troops are dying over there in a war that seems to have no end. I think certainly we can agree that Afghanistan is once again earning its title as the graveyard of empires. Your thoughts, and, of course, what campaign, what kind of campaign is the British National Party running to bring an end to this war?
Well, we're running a very active street-based campaign. We had about 100 different local branches and groups out over the UK, all over England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland today and last weekend as well, collecting petition signatures and handing out leaflets with a simple message, support our troops. You know, we're not a pacifist party. We're very proud of the British military and what they achieve. But support our troops, bring our boys home, because we regard that war as nothing at all to do with Britain. We shouldn't be there. It's an unwinnable war. A lot of people in Britain think it's an American war. It's not really. It's an American elite war. It's a lot of it's connected with the idea of building a pipeline for gas from Tajikistan through to the Indian Ocean. And that's good for so-called American and Saudi Arabian banks and so-called American oil companies and Saudi Arabian oil companies. But it's nothing to do with Britain, and it's nothing to do with the USA, and our boys and your boys shouldn't be dying out there for nothing.
Well, Nick, how many British troops to date have actually been killed in Afghanistan?
Well, it's the figure 2 days ago was 335, which doesn't sound a lot, but yes, 335 of our very best. And when you consider that at any one time on the front line there's probably about 2,500, the simple fact at the moment is that our casualty rate over there is worse than America's at the height of the Vietnam War. It's worse than Britain's in the Korean War. It's as bad as anything we've had since the Second World War. And you know, if that had to be in a war that was connected with Britain and British interests, it's a price that the British National Party would pay. You know, these lads are volunteers. We'd send them up properly equipped. But this isn't a war to do with us. It's somebody else's war. And it's absolutely scandalous that the British Army is being slowly bled to death in a conflict that's nothing to do with us.
Well, Nick, Nick and Bill, if I can interject here, we're coming up on our first commercial break of tonight, and I think this is a good place to take pause and remind everyone that Nick Griffin, chairman of the British National Party, member of European Parliament, is with us tonight, live, unrehearsed, and uncensored, and we're going to give him the opportunity to speak his mind and advance the ideals of the British National Party without interruption, and I think that is a luxury that men of his caliber, heroes of his caliber, are not often afforded on mainstream radio broadcast, but we are honored to have him with us tonight on the Political Cesspool radio program, and we have got much, much more forthcoming with Nick Griffin over the course of this hour. He's going to be our guest for the entire hour. We're going to continue to ask him about the participation of British military in the war in Afghanistan. We're going to talk to him about the global financial crisis, his work in European Parliament, and much, much more, all right here. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please don't understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand me, baby.
Don't let me be.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am fielding emails right now. Of course, we're sitting in studio right now interviewing Nick Griffin, member of European Parliament, live on the air. I am fielding emails right now from all across the country, from California to Florida, people tuning in tonight on this radio program asking, when might Nick Griffin come and do a tour of the United States? They'd love to meet him. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, back to the issue at hand. And that was the war in Afghanistan. And for further questioning along those lines, I turn it back to my co-host, Bill Rowland.
Yes, Nick. There's a perception in the United States, both on the right and the left now, more so on the left, that these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are mercenary wars on behalf of Israel. Does that perception exist in England, and where do you stand on that idea?
Well, that perception doesn't really exist in England in the sort of recognizable mainstream. The war, especially in Iraq, is perceived overwhelmingly as a war for oil. The war in Afghanistan, I guess, perceived this as a crazy war with nothing to do with us. We'd see it as a huge amount to do with a gas pipeline that wants to be built through from Tajikistan through to the Indian Ocean. As for Israel, on the left, a number of people see it as a war there. It's something certainly we look at what Tony Blair, the former British Premier, he was heavily financed by a clique of North London Zionist businessmen. So as far as we're concerned, if you follow the money, you begin to see why something is being done. But in general public terms, they're perceived as wars for oil, for energy, rather than for any particular country or ethnic group.
And finally, obviously this war in Afghanistan has a Muslim connection. It's certainly the Muslims around the world are paying attention to it. Has the war in Afghanistan inflamed or otherwise made Muslims in England more militant and more aggressive?
The war in Iraq and Afghanistan, all these things perceived as, whether they are or not, as attacks nearby the West by the Christian or Crusader West or the Christian Zionist West as attacks on Islamic countries, have massively radicalized opinion amongst young Muslims in Britain, and there's an awful lot of them in Britain, you know, and in Europe. You can look at school after school or street after street in all our main cities, and you think you're in Islamabad already. So it's very heavily radicalized, their opinion. Of course, our political elites say we have to be in Afghanistan to stop terrorism, but the fact is that when our London transport system was attacked by Islamic terrorists a few years ago, 2007, it wasn't by Afghan peasant farmers. It was by third-generation Muslims born and brought up in Britain speaking with local British accents. And part of what has radicalized those people is our elite's wars against, you know, their religion. We've got nothing against Islam. We've got a great deal against the Islamification of Britain and the countries of the West, including the United States. But how the Muslim world runs their own affairs is entirely up to them, and we don't think that we or the USA have got the right to interfere in their countries.
Nick Griffin, I cannot agree with you more. That is an outstanding position to take politically, culturally, domestically, internationally. That is, you know, it's amazing to me that anyone could disagree with such a notion, or that such a notion could be controversial. But we take an America First stand, you take a Britain First stand, and that's the way it should be. That is natural, it's healthy, it's wholesome. And I want to explore that a little bit further, but as we begin to talk a little bit about the Muslim influx into Great Britain, you know, obviously here in America we share a border with Mexico, and we are being inundated with illegal aliens from that third world country. Great Britain, of course, doesn't share a border with Mexico, but it is also being inundated in a similar fashion with those from the Muslim world. And I'd like to ask you this. Is there a correlation, Nick, between mass immigration and the unemployment and financial chaos that has resulted throughout the first world from this third world migration?
Well, yeah, James, there's certainly something of a correlation. And obviously, it's just, you know, simply do the mathematics. If you're looking at a limited number of houses, a limited number of jobs, a limited amount of medical care, and then you increase the number of people, especially people who have never paid in their lives before to the system, you know, coming in at the last minute, then you've got a problem. So immigration makes it worse. But I think it's naive and simplistic to say that this is just an immigration problem. You know, we, the native people of Britain, the native people of the USA, all over the world, we would have a huge problem economically and socially if there wasn't a scrap of immigration, if there wasn't a single Mexican in America or Muslim immigrants in Britain. We'd have a problem because the banksters and the politicians they bought and paid for, they've wrecked the economy of the Western world. There's nothing to do with immigration. It's a hideously corrupt financial system that's screwing us all. As a matter of fact, it's screwing immigrants and people in the third world every bit as much as us. And that's a to deal with that is a separate issue to dealing with immigration.
Well, that's certainly true. There is they are correlated in some ways, but in other ways, immigration and the financial chaos are two separate entities. I'd like to ask you one follow-up question with regard to the financial matter before I explore immigration a little bit further. What is the BNP's plan to, for lack of a better term, level the playing field and create a fair banking system?
Well, the key thing, as far as we're concerned, is that a huge amount of power rests with whoever creates the credit of a nation state. And we believe that that power to create credit should rest with the democratically elected government, whereas for decades now throughout the Western world, that power has rested with essentially private banks, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve. You know, they masquerade as national banks. They're not. They run by and for their private corporation shareholders and owners. They create the credit. It gives them the power to create the nation's credit literally at the stroke of a pen or the click of a keyboard. And that's the core problem here. This power needs to be taken back from democratically elected governments of the nations concerned.
Hear, hear. Now, let me ask you one follow-up question on immigration, Nick, that I think is somewhat related. Obviously, when you want to secure your borders, if America wants to secure its borders, if Great Britain wants to secure its borders, it is met with accusations of racism. Now, these charges would never be levied if it were a third world nation, for instance, wanting to secure their borders and protect their cultural heritage. There is an obvious and egregious double standard in play. It exists across the Western world, and what it is this. Ethnic minorities. Now, globally, obviously, those of European descent are a minority, but in Great Britain and obviously America, we still maintain a majority for now. But there is a double standard that exists. The ethnic minorities in our countries can have spokesmen, and they can have organizations that advance their self-interests and their ideas. But we are not allowed to have such organizations or spokespeople on our side. When they do rise up, when they want to preserve and protect our cultural heritage, they are labeled as racist. We have about 45 seconds left before the break. Nick, how do we present our ideas as healthy and wholesome and get people to come on board and have them not be afraid of being accused falsely with these terms?
Well, James, obviously there's no silver bullet. You know, our enemies have a massive control on the media and the school system and so on, so it's difficult. I think probably the key to it is they've created the concept of racism and they demonized it. You know, it's a phrase created by the mass murderer Leon Trotsky in the first place.
Yes,
but they
yes.
demonize racism. Rather than trying to say, well, perhaps we're racist or we're not racist, I think the thing to do is to go for the jugular and to say that they're the racists, that the victims of racism in the Western world now are the indigenous majority, you know, European Americans, Brits in Britain, French people in France.
Nick,
and we just need to play the racist card because we're the victims now.
Nick, hold on. That is an excellent answer. That is what the Political Cesspool Radio program is all about. Stay tuned, everybody. Got to take a break. We're going to be back with Nick Griffin for more right after this.
Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. I'd like to remind you that our guest this evening on the air with us right now is Nick Griffin, member of European Parliament, also the chairman of the British National Party, staying up well past midnight in London to be with us tonight on the Political Cesspool Radio program. He's been very gracious, and we are most appreciative for that. I am getting swamped with emails right now from people tuning into this interview. I'd like to remind you that if you want to touch base with me, go to our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org, thepoliticalcesspool.org. While there, you can navigate over to our contact page and send me an email. My new book is available there, as well as all information about this radio program. Got an email right here from Sean in Salisbury. He writes, "Hi, James and all, listening to the live broadcast with our great leader, Nick Griffin. Nick Griffin is a legend. Best wishes. And I've gotten more emails than you would imagine conveying messages with a similar sentiment. And I agree. He is a legend. He is a hero. He has accomplished that which we hope many others will do. He has run based upon the courage of his convictions. He has been elected, and he has led with honor and dignity, and he has paid a price for that. And I can relate, and very proud to have Nick Griffin on tonight. Now, that being said, still got about a half hour left with our interview with Nick tonight. Turning it back over to Bill Rowland as we continue to explore other issues. Bill?
Nick, the growth of Islam in Europe corresponds to what seems to be a decline in faith in Christianity, not only in Britain, but all throughout what used to be called Christendom. And the BNP, obviously being a political party, addresses things on a cultural, a political level, but is this not also a crisis of faith to some degree, that Islam rises throughout what used to be the stronghold of Christianity around the world?
Yeah, Bill, you're very, very faint there. I can only catch part of that, I'm afraid. This is a little bit on the tricky side. We've got some technical problem, I think. You can hear me. I can't hear you too well at all. But on the question, really, of Islam and Christianity, if you go back just 40 years ago, there was one mosque in Britain, which was established by a rather eccentric British Army officer who'd spent his time out in India, and now there's over 1,000. They're run by and financed by some of the most extreme Islamic radicals in the world, from especially Saudi Arabia. Britain, which is a country which owes its freedom, its heritage, all our traditions are based on Christianity. Even if you're not an active Christian, you have to understand that they come from and they're based on Christianity. And we're now a country where, within a few years, there'll be more people going to a mosque on a Friday than there will be going to, to any kind of church on a Sunday. And frankly, it's a terrifying thing. I've got three lovely daughters, and the idea of them growing up in an Islamic state just horrifies me. I've got nothing against Muslims in their own country, but their way is incompatible with our way, and I want to see our way stay on top in the West.
Well, Nick, you've hit it on the head. It's not as though we're being motivated by hatred of other religions or other races, but we want those races to thrive in their own countries. What is love if not loving your own family and your own heroes and your own heritage a little bit more than that of other people? To me, that is the definition of love, and we want to preserve and protect our heroes and our heritage and our culture. And that's what the BNP is doing. That's what this radio show attempts to do here in this country. And I couldn't agree with you more. But Bill, I know you've got some follow-up questions along those lines. As we fight to preserve and protect not only Western civilization, but Christendom as well.
Yes, Nick, do you consider mosques to be outposts of Muslim radicalism? In this country, we see mosques going up everywhere on college campuses. Do you feel that mosques invariably become outposts of Muslim radicalism?
Yes, I do, Bill. I think people misunderstand, especially people with perhaps a faintly Christian background. They think, well, religion is something you take or leave, and it vaguely influences how you view your world. To a good Muslim, Islam is the be-all and end-all. And their role is to spread their religion through what they call the Dar al-Harb, the land of war, which is distinct from the land of peace, Dar al-Islam. And we're in the land of war, and their job as good Muslims is to do whatever they can, through fair means or foul, to spread their religion and to make it take over the world. And the thing is that, yes, there can be moderate forms of Islam, but the radical forms of Islam are the ones sitting on vast amounts of oil wealth. They're the ones pushing forward. So you bet your life that any mosque established, whether it's in Britain or France or Holland or the USA, will be financed by the more radical stream, in fact, the more fundamentalist traditional stream of Islam. And it may be a good thing. They look after their own people. They trade together. They look for ways to set their youngsters up in business. They push their own agenda forward. you bet your life that's good for them, but it's bad for us.
Well, that's rather stunning because, as I said, in this country, mosques are going up everywhere, being built all over the country, including the American South, which has been called the buckle of the Bible Belt. And, in fact, there's even Christian outreach to these Muslims. Is that also going on in Britain? And what is the BNP going to do about Muslim mosques going up and essentially being citadels of radical and militant Islam?
Well, there's effectively no outreach towards Muslims from Christianity in Britain. Christianity in Britain is dominated now by a liberal leftist clergy who really just seem to want to roll over and play dead. They're constantly betraying what they stand for. So there's no resistance. There's about 40,000 young Brits, bear in mind that's about of a population of 60 million, top whack, convert to Islam each year. There's a huge conversion rate amongst the black prison population in this country. There's still massive immigration. And, of course, the combination of the Islamic birth rate, which is very high, and the correspondingly high death rate of an elderly British population means that the population shift is taking place at a rate, it's 14 to 1. It's a catastrophic speed. And we're going to be a minority in not just ethnic, but also religious and cultural terms in our own homeland within 40 or 50 years, if things carry on as they are. Now, what we're doing to try and stop it, wherever we have locally elected members of councils and so on, we push very hard to resist local planning permission changes to allow the establishment of mosques. And most of all, we simply warn that there's no possibility that radicalized Islam can be accommodated in a modern democratic Western society. So we're just, we're the Paul Revere ringing the alarm bells. We're not saying the Brits are coming, we're saying the Muslims are coming, and you better wake up.
Well, we are having our own version of the British invasion tonight here on the Political Cesspool Radio program with Nick Griffin, but that's okay because that was good music. But I got another email here. Thank you so much for having our, hero and legend, Nick. You're a living legend, a hero of your own time. Thank you so much for having our hero, Nick Griffin, on your radio show. Much appreciated. I'm a proud member of the BNP and firmly believe that Nick is our only hope of rescuing our once great nation from the corrupt government and the Muslim extremists. That comes from Andy in the United Kingdom. So lots of people tuned in tonight, apparently over there on your side of the pond, Nick, and we're very proud to welcome them tonight to our broadcast. Hopefully they'll stick around. We got 3 hours tonight, 2 hours even after you leave. But want to turn now the focus a little bit to the future. And we know that we're fighting a retreating battle right now on many important fronts, but hope does remain eternal that we will be able to turn the tides and begin to take back that which has been taken from us, and that we'll be able to reclaim America's destiny and reclaim Great Britain's destiny and return them to their previous standing. Nick, let's talk about your work in European Parliament. How are you using your very prominent elected office to preserve and protect British heritage?
Well, quite a bit of it is, in fact, symbolic. You know, the power in the European Union, unfortunately, doesn't lie with the elected representatives. It lies with unelected bureaucrats. Behind them, there's a whole wave of lobbyists. Behind them, there's some of the biggest, greediest corporations on the planet. So, to an extent, that's symbolic. But we're operating at two levels within that sort of parameter. One is on a practical basis. For example, I sit on the Environmental Committee. At present, there's a wave of European Commission proposals. We're dealing with these next week. Just one example, that the manufacturers of small light haulage vans should be forced to radically change their carbon emissions in a way which really makes them pretty much unviable and would drive huge numbers of businesses out of business.
Hey, Nick, sorry to interrupt. I apologize. We've got to take a break. We're going to let you pick up right where you're leaving off.
Okay, righty ho.
Right back. If it's the last thing we ever do, we got to get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me. If I didn't tell him, I didn't. Welcome back.
to get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, our final segment tonight. It goes by far too quickly when you have guests of the caliber of Nick Griffin on your program. We have just one more fleeting segment with Nick, and we want to take full advantage of every second. Nick, before the break came up last segment, you were talking to us about how you were using your office to advance our ideas.
Yeah, indeed. So I was talking about especially these. This is one example of proposed restrictions on carbon emissions on new-built light vans. And this is an absolute knife edge, whether it goes through or not. The arguing against and voting against it means that possibly we can maintain some form of sanity, because as far as we're concerned, this whole climate change business is a leftist corporate nonsense designed to screw ordinary people and decent businesses. And there's a chance next week that we can knock it back. So on one level, we're dealing with purely practical things like that. On the other hand, a couple of weeks ago, we had a fascinating talk from a Greek Cypriot, a professor of archaeology, who gave a terrifying expose, really, of what the Turkish Muslims had done in northern Cyprus, which they've occupied illegally since the 1970s, where every single one of the 550 churches, Christian churches, in northern Cyprus has been desecrated, in many cases literally flattened, by this Muslim invasion. It's something which isn't understood or known pretty much anywhere in Europe. I don't think anywhere in the United States either. But getting this kind of message across is something really important in terms of the big picture.
Well, Bill, you know, I know that the BNP is looking with a very keen eye on that situation developing with the churches that Nick just made mention of. We've paid attention to that as well. And I know, Bill, I think your next question has to do with whether or not a coalition of sorts could come together to perhaps put an end to situations like that. Bill?
Well, Nick, I had a question about the relationship the BNP might have with other rightist European parties and the success those parties have had in their own countries and in the European Parliament. What, if any, relationship does the BNP have with, for instance, the Front National in France, Jobbik in Hungary, or some of the other rightist parties throughout Europe?
Yes, Bill, we have a very good working relationship with a number of the nationalist parties in Europe, the Front National and Jobbik from Hungary in particular, and then a rather softer relationship with people, say, like the Vlaams Belang from Flanders, from northern Belgium. So there's a significant minority, quite a vocal minority, within the European Parliament of people who are overtly nationalists, standing up for our culture, our identity, economies to be run for our own people, and so on. Then there's a separate wave of what we would call civic nationalists, people who sort of say they're nationalists, but as far as they're concerned, anyone who can walk into Britain or France, you know, it could be British or French, regardless of where they come from, how soon they've arrived, and so on, which is something we don't hold with. Your nationality is partly a matter of culture and language. It's also, in the countries of the West, a matter of blood and descent. So with these civic nationalists, we have some relationship, and certainly we've got a lot more common in with them than we have with the conservative capitalists, near the liberals on the left. So there is an alliance there. We're outnumbered, but we're growing. Every election that goes by, really, there's another European country where the population turns to some extent to a nationalism. You know, we're demonized, all sorts of dirty tricks are played against us in electoral terms in the media, and whatever they do to us, we still keep coming. So I think there's a serious hope for the future that together the nations of Europe are going to wake up. Our people are awake, in fact, but at present they're scared, they're demoralized, they in some places lack leadership, but people are waking up, and I simply don't believe that this fantastic, wonderful culture of Europe, and obviously transposed to the United States, which has given the world all the great concepts of, you know, freedom, democracy, equality for women, decent treatment for animals even. I don't believe that civilization will go quietly into the night. We're alive, we're kicking here in Western Europe, and we're not going to go down. We're not even going to lose. We're the future, not the past.
Nick Griffin, what an inspiring commentary you just delivered. Now, all I can say in response to that is amen. You know, it is a matter of blood and bone. We're not all interchangeable parts. You can't have a first world nation with a third world population, and I don't want to be forced to trade down, not for my family. And with that being said, I know we're beginning to run short on time, but thank God we have people like you and parties like the British National Party who are advancing these interests, who are speaking candidly and frankly about these issues to a degree that no one else does. And I'd like to ask you this. Not all of us can be members of European Parliament. Not all of us are members of right-of-center political parties. But I would ask you this. What sort of a coalition can nationalists in Great Britain and America form on a very basic level that would be beneficial to the overall cause?
Well, I think partly it's a matter, James, of just keeping in touch, looking at each other's websites and so on, and where one party or one group come up with a good idea, you know, don't be ashamed to learn from it and take advantage of what other people are doing and leapfrog things, you know, and come on, get involved. It's partly a matter of people talking to each other. I think most of all, it's a matter of people forgetting the idea that there's someone on a white horse, you know, in shining armor about to rescue us. The only thing that you can do is to get involved in your own area, your own community, start speaking up for what's right and decent and just, you know, on a local level, get respect from your local, from your neighbors and so on, and get appointed or elected to some quite lowly position which marks you out in some way from the rest of the herd and gives you the start of a voice. I think probably the greatest failing in the United States, several generations of United States patriots have said, we're going to go for the presidency when control of a local dog pound is up for grabs in votes, and there's no point going for the top until you've secured the grassroots. And this has to be a grassroots rebellion because the elites aren't on our side. You know, whatever they are, whether they're from an alien group or whether they're impeccably WASP, the elites are there for themselves, for their own interest groups, for their own money, and our people have to start doing it from the grassroots upwards.
You're absolutely right. Now, I'll ask this as my final question, and this is all we have time for before we move into the next hour. You know, here in America, the closest thing we have to the BNP is the American Third Position Party. It's a party to which I belong. We have the Council of Conservative Citizens. We have this radio program. So we do have organizations and entities out there. And I would encourage everyone listening here in America to join up, support the organizations that we have, and build them up from the grassroots, as Nick has mentioned. But as far as the BNP goes, I asked you this last year, Nick. I want to ask you this again. How can good and decent Christian Americans here in the United States who want to support the British National Party, can we do it from here? And how can we learn more information about the BNP?
Yes, you can do it. Come on our website, www.bnp.org.uk. That's bnp.org.uk. Take a look there. Contribute to our online forums and so on. There's a rule in Britain which stops anyone who's not on our local electoral roll in the UK. You can't give more than £500, that's about, $750 in a year to the British National Party, but anyone wants to give that amount can do. If people by chance want to give more, there's ancillary groups. There's a tremendous independent nationalist trade union, Solidarity, which is growing quite rapidly in Britain now, and there's no limits to what can be given there. And probably most important of all, it's, you know, if you come to Britain, if you're going to come, get in touch with us and meet up with people over here. It's all too easy for nationalists when they see the power of the mass media, our opponents and so on. They think perhaps we're alone, perhaps we're helpless. And the most important thing, I think, is for people to realise we're not alone, we're not helpless. There's millions of people of our stock all around the world who are passionately committed to preserving our people, our culture, our traditions, our freedom. We've just got to get together, support each other, and we can work mountains.
Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Griffin, can't say enough about him. Support him. Support the BNP. Check it out at bnp.org. UK. Nick, I'm sure some of the members of your party who are tuned in tonight are just shocked that a radio program such as ours exists. But we've been doing this for 6 years, shows like this each and every week. We got two more hours tonight. We encourage everyone to stay tuned and keep checking up on us here at the Political Cesspool. And Nick, can't thank you enough, my friend, for making time for our audience tonight, taking an hour out of your busy schedule to stay up with us well past midnight to share with us your ideas and your thoughts and your visions. I know you're going to be back in the European Parliament next week, but you're with us tonight, and Godspeed to you.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Bill, and God bless all your listeners.
Nick Griffin, everybody, British National Party, support them. They deserve it. And we will be back with more, much more, in fact, right after these words from our sponsors. I'm James Edwards, co-hosting with me tonight, Bill Rowland. Got a very interesting program. Still 2 hours left, and we're going to cover a lot of hot topics that you're not going to want to miss. In the meantime, what'd you think about that Nick Griffin interview? Let me know. Go to our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. Send me an email, and we would love to read some of your responses on the air in some of the forthcoming segments.
One hour down.
We're going to pick it up right there, right after this.
Stay tuned. Hour number two of The Political Cesspool comes your way right after these messages.
And Harv leaped to his feet and says, something's got a hold on me. Yow! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting, hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
Well, Harv hit the aisles dancing and screaming. Some thought he had religion, others thought he had a demon. And Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his Fruit of the Looms. He fell to his knees to plead and beg, and the squirrel ran out of his britches leg unobserved to the other side of the room. All the way down to the 8th.